Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
Following the reaction to journalist Stephen Brill's 2013 Time Magazine special report examining medical bills line by line that won the National Magazine Award, Brill set out to chronicle how the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, was written, how it was being implemented, and most important, how it would change or not change the abuses that he had exposed. In April 2014, as Brill was completing his reporting of the roller coaster saga of Obamacare, he was told he needed urgent open heart surgery and became a desperate patient, looking up from the gurney at the system he thought he understood. He writes about this in his new book, America's Bitter Pill: Money, Politics, Backroom Deals, and the Fight to Fix Our Broken Healthcare System. Stephen Brill has written for The New Yorker, Time, and The New York Times Magazine. He's a graduate of Yale College and Yale Law School. He also founded and ran Court TV, The American Lawyer Magazine, 10 regional legal newspapers, as well as Brill's Content Magazine. Again, the title of the new book is America's Bitter Pill. It is published by Random House, and we welcome Stephen Brill to the roundtable this morning. Stephen, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
You're welcome. It's good to be with you.
What brought you to the subject, and really not to just take on the Affordable Health Care Act, but to look at this in a very large context?
It's actually pretty simple. I was just curious, and what I was curious about was why, during the debate over Obamacare, the debate was always about, well, how do we pay for the exorbitant cost of health care in the United States? What kind of insurance should we have? How do we get people so that they can afford the very high price of health care in the United States? And at the same time that debate was going on, there were lots of debates out there, lots of magazine articles being written about people whose loved ones were terminally ill, and they had to face the dilemma of, well, if I have to spend $500,000 for 6 months more of chemotherapy to keep my loved one alive, you know, how can I do it? Should I do it? Or, you know, $1 million to keep someone alive for a year. And my reaction to all that, maybe it's because I have a background as an entrepreneur as well as a journalist, was, well, why does it cost $500,000? Why does it cost $1 million? Why is healthcare so expensive in the United States? So the core of this book takes people's actual medical bills, hospital bills and pharmaceutical bills and all the rest, and looks at them line by line and follows the money. And what I discovered was that everybody in healthcare, except for the doctors and nurses, is just making too much money, including, in fact, particularly, the so-called nonprofit hospitals, which make very high operating profits all across the country. In communities, whether, you know, they're big cities or small towns, the local hospital or hospitals are typically the most profitable businesses with the most highly compensated executives. And again, I'm not talking about doctors. I'm talking about the president of the hospital, even though they're so-called nonprofits, they're charities, and they have an annual charity dinner that, you know, that maybe raises 0.5% of the money they have every year. The real money comes by charging $77 for a box of gauze pads that's hidden in the bill, or, you know, $2,000 a night just for the room. And that's what this book is about, which is the very high cost of health care, and then examines what happened with Obamacare, the orgy of lobbying around Obamacare, and the result was, the good news is, many more people did get access to health care, but nothing changed about the price of health care in this country. The prices are still way too high.
So a lot of things that you just mentioned that I want to focus on. First of all, this all came out of a Time magazine piece that you did 2 years ago.
Right.
And looking at the bill line by line. So you wanted to go more into that. Were you surprised by the reaction to that article of really?
I was stunned.
Yeah.
I was stunned, although I guess I shouldn't have been, because everybody's been through this. Everybody's gotten a medical bill that surprises them. Everybody's gotten an explanation of benefits from their insurance company that totally mystifies them. And what I was surprised about was that this was sort of going on in plain sight. At every hospital in the country, they have this thing called the charge master, which is their list of 10,000 items that they charge for. And the charge master can include things like mucus control device. That's a tissue. And they can charge $10 for a box of tissues. Or cough suppressant device. That's a teddy bear that that people who've had open heart surgery or any kind of surgery in their chest get to cling to because that helps you stop coughing. And that could be $100. And then there are hospitals that charge for the cuff they put around your arm when they take your blood pressure. Now, that's relatively small stuff, but it adds up. And then for the big items, they charge a lot more. But what really stunned me was that there's no control on this. It's just everybody involved is just totally unaccountable, in part because they are nonprofit organizations. They're seen as charities. And the reality is they do great work. I mean, they do cure the sick. They take care of people who are sick. So it's hard to cast them as villains. It's just that it's an alternate universe. The healthcare industry in this country is an alternate universe. They didn't get the memo about there being a recession, for example. Through the recession, their prices kept going up. The salaries, the multi-million-dollar salaries of hospital presidents kept going up. In the last 3 years, the average compensation of a hospital president at a nonprofit hospital in this country has gone up 22%, when the compensation of doctors, on average, has gone up about 1%.
So when it comes to the hospitals, as you mentioned, the only people who don't seem to be doing well in this, besides the patients and us as Americans, are the nurses and the doctors. So you would think if there is going to be an uprising, it's going to come from there.
Well, they don't have the power they used to have. Back in the 1950s and 60s, the American Medical Association was able to block President Truman and his effort to get some kind of national health care because they claimed that it would be socialized medicine. They were able to block a lot of other reforms. But the powers that be in healthcare today are, the medical device makers have more lobbying clout. The people who sell artificial knees and hips have more lobbying clout than the doctors do. And by the way, I should add that we spend more money on artificial hips and knees in the United States than Hollywood takes in at the box office.
Wow. When you look at the addressing of the problem through Obamacare and the Affordable Care Act, you write rather early in the book that the president is quoted as saying there is a moral component to this that we can't leave behind. He said, if we don't address costs, we will not get this done. So that's a long way of asking a simple question is, okay, well, what happened?
Well, the president's instincts were right. There were two things that are commonly thought of when people talk about health care reform. One is give people access to health care. We're the only country, the only developed country where most people, if not all of them, have access to health care that is provided by the government in some way. So the first issue is access. The second issue is cost. And what the president was told early on was what Governor Romney was told in Massachusetts early on when he did Romney Care. And Obamacare, by the way, is just a slightly more conservative version of Romney Care. What the president was told was, if you're going to do coverage, you can't do costs. The lobbyists, the powers that be in Washington, will never let you do much about costs because when you cut costs, you're taking away their incomes. And the president rhetorically kept talking about costs, but as I explain in the book, in the White House, there was a fight between his economics staff, which wanted to address costs more heavily, and the political staff and the policy staff, and the Democrats on Capitol Hill, who resisted efforts to address costs because they said if we do that, we're just never going to get this bill out because it'll be so heavily lobbied, it'll be killed, which is what happened with Hillary Clinton. So they made a series of deals with the drug companies. They basically punted on any effort to control the cost of drugs. With the hospitals, they punted on any efforts to control the cost of hospitals. In return, the drug companies and the hospitals supported Obamacare. And the reason they supported Obamacare is, guess what? Obamacare creates tens of millions of new customers who can pay, because they'll have insurance, who can pay the high cost of drugs and the high cost of hospitals. So that's how reform happened. So, yes, the president talked about it. His speeches were real good, but when it came to the nitty-gritty of writing the 965 pages of the law, you got to look really hard in those 965 pages to see anything that in any substantial way cuts into the ridiculous cost structure of healthcare in this country.
And as you just stated, and as you talk about in the book, it seems like the only reason that, as far as the Obama administration was concerned, that we don't do that and we don't address that more forcefully is because otherwise this wouldn't pass and it would be a failed agenda.
Right. What this book is about as its core is what happens when you take the largest but most dysfunctional industry sector in the country, an industry the size of the economy of France, healthcare, totally dysfunctional, but rich, and you try to reform it in a dysfunctional Washington where money talks. What happens is that the healthcare industry spends four times as much on lobbying as the next industry, which is the military-industrial complex. So what you get in the name of, quote, reform, unquote, is a law that enriches that industry, doesn't cut into the profits they make. It's just the reality of Washington. You know, it's the reality of our country. And I think that reality is only going to change when there's a crisis, when the deductibles in all of our policies become so high, when the coinsurance becomes so high, when the demands on the Treasury become so high because the cost of subsidizing all the people in Obamacare who are getting insurance, when all that becomes so high that we just choke on it. Now, everybody thought we were going to choke on it when the percent we spend on health care of the gross domestic product, you know, got over 10%. Then they thought, well, we're going to choke when it gets to be over, 13%. Then 14%. It's now approaching 20%.
So, and I guess that goes back to my earlier question. I mean, if not now, when? I mean, it seems that with that of wanting to take on this issue and the political risks for all parties involved of saying, okay, that we must have reached some crisis point. So it looks like now we've just kicked the ball down the road a little until we hit the next crisis point.
I think that's right. But, we could be having this conversation about, climate change. We could be having
Absolutely.
This conversation about infrastructure.
Right.
I mean, infrastructure is actually pretty interesting. There was a bridge that fell down over a highway in Ohio the other day, right? And, we've all been talking for years about we've got to invest in our infrastructure. We've got to invest in our infrastructure, our highways, our airports. We know that intellectually, but we don't do anything about it because it's not a crisis. Well, what if, God forbid, 10 bridges had fallen down that day? In 10 places around the country, we would have an infrastructure bill out of Washington in 2 weeks because that would be a crisis. So here, I don't know what the tipping point is going to be, but I suspect there is going to be a tipping point because, the president's going to be blamed for a lot of things he shouldn't be blamed for. Every time some, human resources department meets with the employees at a company every year and says, well, we have to raise your deductibles, we have to raise your coinsurance, we have to narrow the network of doctors that are in our policy because of Obamacare. Well, it has nothing to do with Obamacare. That's been going on for 15 years because the costs keep going up, so the insurance coverage has to keep going down for the employer to be able to afford the insurance. Well, that's going to keep happening. And at some point, even those of us who have jobs and have insurance provided by our employers, the out-of-pocket cost is going to become so high that sooner or later the people are going to be able to trump the lobbyists because it'll be a crisis.
Stephen Brill is our guest. His new book is America's Bitter Pill: Money, Politics, Backroom Deals, and the Fight to Fix Our Broken Healthcare System. The book is published by Random House. We'll return to our conversation with Stephen Brill after this short break.
Welcome back to the Roundtable. Stephen Brill is our guest. His new book is America's Bitter Pill: Money, Politics, Backroom Deals, and the Fight to Fix Our Broken Healthcare System. The book is published by Random House, already a bestseller. And one of the things, Stephen, that I want to talk to you about in our second section here is that as you're writing this book and you're looking through all of these bills line by line, you're talking to all parties involved, you're going into this just, you know, fully immersed. And then you yourself have a health crisis that really puts you as the patient and you get a whole new perspective.
Exactly. And fully immersed is exactly the right word. I was so fully immersed that when this happened, and what happened was at the tail end of my reporting, at the end of March, I was getting a routine checkup and my doctor discovered something and said, you need urgent open heart surgery. I had something called an aortic aneurysm, which is a bubble on your heart. And if it bursts, and in my case, there was a 17% chance at any time that it could burst, you just die. I mean, you don't even get to the emergency room. But it's, you know, completely fixable, and it was fixed, and I'm in fine health now, as I was before. I didn't have any symptoms. This was totally sudden. I was so immersed that the first night I'm in the hospital, you know, about to go into the operating room the next morning, I actually thought I was dreaming that I was in the hospital. I thought this was, you know, just... when you get immersed in something, you know how, you know, at night you dream about it, you know, you just can't take it off your mind. So here I am in a hospital in the middle of reporting about hospital bills. And I thought that, you know, what's my charge master price? You know, what's the bill for this x-ray they're giving me going to be? What's the bill for this blood test they're giving me going to be? But what it did do, as you point out, is it brought home in an emotional and personal way what I sort of knew intellectually, which was that healthcare is not a normal product you can buy in a marketplace. You know, it's not like you're deciding what kind of smartphone to buy. You know, you sort of know what you need. You can compare prices. You can talk to people about it. You have a general understanding of what you want. And if the price is too high, you can always decide not to get a new smartphone. Here, you don't just say, gee, I think I'll wander over to the hospital and see what they're charging for open heart surgery today. And if I don't like their price, you know, maybe I'll go across the street. You have no idea what you need. You have no idea about the quality of the care you're going to get. You don't know if you need, you know, 6 blood tests a day or 3. And when you get the bill, you have no idea what it means. And in my case, as I'm explaining in the book, after I got out of the hospital, I had gotten 36 different first-class envelopes one day with 36 different explanations of benefits from my insurance company. So I figured, well, I'm just going to dig into this because I'm this smart guy who knows all this stuff. So obviously I'll open up these things and I'll understand what I got. And the third one I opened said amount billed, 0. Amount you owe, $154.20. And God knows I couldn't figure that out. As it happened, I had an interview scheduled for a few weeks later when I was able to travel with the CEO of United Healthcare, my insurance company, about, you know, Obamacare and the lobbying they had done over Obamacare and how it affected their industry and all the rest of that. So I go out for the interview. It's a very productive interview, very good guy. And at the end, I handed him that explanation of benefits. I said, you know, could you help me out here? Could you explain this to me? And he looked at it, and he looked at it, and he looked at it, and then looked up and said, I could sit here all day and I couldn't explain this to you. I have no idea what it means, and I have no idea why they sent it to you. And I said, well, aren't you they? And the point of the story really is that this is the most frequent communication we as healthcare consumers get about the product we're buying, the explanation of benefits. In the largest industry in the country that thinks of itself as having the most vibrant consumer-oriented free market in the world, and the CEO of the company that sends out that document doesn't even understand it.
You write in the book, what did it say about the competence and purpose of an industry, I thought, when the chief executive of its largest, most successful company can't explain the most basic communication he sends to his customers? So let's focus on two words, competence and purpose. We have a pretty good idea of the competence, I guess, but of the purpose. So their purpose is purely profit?
Well, the health insurance industry is a for-profit industry. As I point out in the book, they have the lowest profit margins of any of the players in the industry. The drug companies have higher profit margins than Google. The medical device makers have higher profit margins than Apple. The supposed nonprofit hospitals have really significant operating profit margins. In fact, their operating profit margins are higher than the for-profit hospitals. The insurance companies have negligible profit margins. And what I suggest at the end of the book is that what we ought to do is allow and encourage the large hospital systems that are proliferating all over the country, that are gobbling up doctors' practices and buying up smaller hospitals. We ought to sort of let that happen because it's going to happen anyway. But we should encourage them to sell their own insurance so that if there's a prominent hospital in the community that owns a lot of doctors' practices or is affiliated with, tons of doctors, owns all the testing clinics around, which is increasingly happening, why don't I give them $10,000 a year for my health insurance and say to the president of that hospital system, you keep me healthy? That would eliminate the incentive the hospital would have to over-test me because they're just going to be billing themselves for the test. It would eliminate all the incentives they have to over-treat or over-test. And they're a better brand name that I can hold accountable than an insurance company. Right now the insurance company is the one that decides whether I can get a certain treatment or a certain procedure. Here it would be the doctors. So I suggest that, but I only suggest it if it's tightly regulated as a monopoly or as an oligopoly so that they can't skimp on the care.
You do address...
So basically what I'm suggesting is that the insurance companies are gradually going to go out of business, because if you're a hospital system that owns all the doctors and all the clinics in a given community, the insurance companies have no leverage to bargain with you, because if they don't pay your prices, they can't sell insurance.
Do you see that happening sooner rather than later?
Yeah, it is happening. It's happening around the country. It's happening in some not so good ways. For example, in Western Pennsylvania, where a system called the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center basically dominates everything, but there's no regulation on their prices. In New Haven, Connecticut, Yale New Haven hospital system totally dominates that metropolitan area, but with no regulation. I think it's okay if they dominate, but if they're regulated in a way that we regulate, the electric company that sells us electricity and which is dominant.
So basically it's taking off a black hat and putting on another head.
Yeah, you could say that. But, the real solution would have been in 1943 when the War Labor Board in the Roosevelt administration allowed employers to provide health insurance to employees and said that's not the equivalent of raising wages, because during the war you weren't allowed to raise wages. And then the IRS said that that's not a taxable income, that health insurance. That opened the door for employers to provide health insurance to their employees in a way that didn't happen in any other country. And once that happened, the political pressure for government to supply the insurance was not there. And in fact, the unions in the 1940s opposed government health insurance because the unions were using the advent of them getting health insurance written into their union contracts as a recruiting tool. So they said to the Roosevelt administration, you know, don't get in our way. This is something we want to provide through the employers and through our union contracts. So if you could rewrite history, you might have, you know, government, you know, single payer that you have in most other countries, but it's unrealistic to think we can do that.
It's hard to read your book and think optimistically that even if there is another crisis, or barring a you know, monumental crisis, that there is going to be a presidential administration that's going to roll up its sleeves and say, okay, let's fix this once and for all.
Well, I think in fairness, the Obama administration did roll up its sleeves, but then had to face reality. I think the larger question as to whether a presidential administration is going to do this is what are the people going to do? Because the only time lobbyists are trumped is when something becomes such a crisis issue that the people who get elected for a living start to listen to the people instead of listening to lobbyists. And that's rare, but it happens. I guess the incurable optimist in me, you know, sort of says that I think things are going to get so bad that they're going to get good.
And when you think of your care and how you're feeling now and having been a part of the system, and even though there wasn't an explanation for that bill,
right,
when you come out of it, you're healthy.
Yeah. And yeah, I mean, that's what we have to keep, you know, we can't lose sight of the fact that we're not talking about people who wake up in the morning and go to the office and make, you know, violent video games or porn movies. We're talking about people who wake up in the morning and go to an office and organize a system and work in a system that cures the sick, that alleviates pain, that prevents death. And we, you know, we have to respect them for that. We have to honor them for that. We have to love them for that. But we also have to be, you know, pretty clear-eyed about the fact that except for the doctors and the nurses, they're all just making too much money doing it.
Stephen Brill is the author of America's Bitter Pill, Money, Politics, Backroom Deals, and the Fight to Fix Our Broken Healthcare System. The book is published by Random House. Stephen Brill, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks very much. Again, the title of the book, America's Bitter Pill, by Stephen Brill. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.